The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Our guest today is Mark Faber. But right before we get to the guest, just a reminder that the latest video that you've put out, David, What is Real Money, can be found at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or on YouTube, typing in McIlvaney Financial. And now since we've gotten that reminder out of the way, David, Mark Faber is one of my favorite guests. And I have to admit, I've got a warm spot in my heart this year for him, because he came out at the beginning of the year before gold really looked like it was doing anything, and he said gold was going to be one of the better picks of the year. He oftentimes does not walk in lockstep with the masses, and I really like that about him.
One of the biggest changes we've seen in our generation is the rise of China. Quite interestingly, he moved to Asia in the 1970s. You recall Deng Xiaoping was introducing ideas which shaped not only China, but now consequently all of Asia in that sequence. And we see the insights that he brings as being very unique, real-time perspective. Not only does he have an investment banking background where he worked for many years in Switzerland, but then he moves to Hong Kong, he now lives in Thailand, he's anchored there. And so to see the pitfalls and opportunities in Asia and to explore sort of global macroeconomic themes, Mark, we enjoy always having you on the program. Mark, it is every year, twice a year, that you join the Barron's Roundtable, and the interview is very distinct. There's, in my view, three of you that tend to have more in common. Fred Hickey, Felix Zulauf, yourself, and then there is the rest. How do you see the contrast in that group, a very erudite group, but still with particular divergence in views?
Well, I do not wish to be critical, but basically most of the participants on the Barron's Roundtable are still very America-centric. They think the center of the world is America, but I would say relative to the rest of the world, the American economy peaked out sometimes in the 1950s, early 1960s, and since then the rest of the world has grown and enlarged its economic sphere dramatically, whereas the U.S. has become a country where growth has been slowing down and where the standards of living, not of the 0.1% richest people, but of the medium household, the typical household, these standards of living have been going down. And if you look at export figures around the world, as a percentage of total exports, U.S. exports are down. If you look at industrial production as a percent of the total world, U.S. industrial production is down, capital spending the same, and so forth and so on. So I'm not saying that the U.S. economy today is not larger than it was in, say, 1960. What I'm suggesting is that other countries have become far more important, including India and China and Russia and Brazil and so forth and so on. So the people that just focus on the U.S., in my opinion, they miss a lot of opportunities overseas. Now, having said that, the U.S. market has just about outperformed any other market since 2011. And now the question for investors arises, do I buy the U.S., which is at a very high level, or do I go into emerging economies or into Europe, which are areas that are far less demanding in terms of valuation?
We have your story. You moved to Asia in the 70s, and so a perspective certainly on Asia, anchored in decades of real-time observation. Perhaps you could look at the short-term and long-term view on China and pitfalls and opportunities you see in the years ahead in Asia in general, perhaps China specifically.
Well, I look at the whole world, and I don't trade stocks. I invest money, and if I have money for investment at the present time, then I have to choose, do I buy the U.S., that has gone up approximately three times since 2009, and where valuations are high, and where the economy at very best will grow at a very slow pace? Or do I go into some emerging economies that have relatively to the U.S. a very low valuation? Now, I do not dispute that maybe the U.S. market is like the U.S. market in 1987 and still goes up, say, 30%. Not every stock moving up, but say the speculative stocks like Netflix and Facebook and Twitter and so on, that they can, and Tesla, that they can move up more. But I think as an investor, if I take, say, a 5 to 10 year view, then I prefer to buy it from a valuation point of view, either Europe, European companies, or emerging market companies. Because I can find in Asia, I can build you a portfolio that has a dividend yield of, say, 5%. So I feel that valuations are particularly low. They're not at bargain level, but they have become, after the break in emerging economies, stock markets, they have become reasonable.
There's reward in the stock market. That has been a feature of the last 5 years. You've pointed out since 2009, things in the U.S. have been very positive, and the U.S. market has outperformed since 2011. Should we assume that risk has been banished from the equation in the context of central bankers choosing to inflate asset prices?
Yes, that is a possibility, but it should be clearly understood that if central banks or any monetary authority wants to inflate asset prices continuously, the monetary inflation has to continuously accelerate. So the credit growth has to accelerate, and then you eventually go into colossal bubble, and eventually the asset inflation shifts to consumer price inflation. And if you look at the last couple of years, say 2000 to today, or 2007 to today, the typical household in America, inflation adjusted, earns less than before. But the very well-to-do people that own assets, and I'm not complaining about myself because I also own assets, they are doing very well. And then you create, with continuous money printing, an environment where social cohesion breaks down, and things at some point in the future, the majority of people is impoverished, they will penalize the well-to-do people through higher taxes or expropriation and so forth and so on.
You know, there was a running assumption of quantitative easing having an inflationary effect. Certainly, quantitative easing 1 and 2, we saw a positive effect on the precious metals. Then quantitative easing 3 and 4 did not. And now in the context of QE reduction, the taper as they describe it, metals have been moving up again. What is the relationship today between the printing press and the precious metals market?
Well, this is a very good question. First of all, the problem that is not recognized by central banks sufficiently, but was already identified by Copernicus and David Hume and Irving Fisher, is that when you print money, not all prices rise equally and at the same time. In other words, you print money, there can be a rise in wages, there can be a rise in commodity prices, there can be a rise in real estate, there can be a rise in NASDAQ stock prices, there can be a rise in blue chip stock prices, there can be a rise in foreign currencies, there can be a rise in art prices, but not all prices go up equally. And that is what the viciousness of money printing brings about. And so my view would be the precious metals were in a bull market 1999 to 2011. And since then, they have corrected. But equity prices continue to rise. And now, say, you get tomorrow $1 million. What is better to buy relatively? Nothing is cheap, but relatively, the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, or gold and silver. In my view, gold and silver are extremely distressed compared to, say, the S&P 500. Now, since November, when I first began to talk about the tremendous undervaluation of mining stocks compared to the S&P, they have rallied strongly. Some stocks like Novagold have doubled in price, and I think I would wait for a correction to increase my position. But this is one of the very few asset classes in the world that is distressed.
In the 1970s, we had the IMF gold sale announcements used as a means of bullying the gold price. How do you respond to the idea of manipulation in the gold market in 2013? Can that continue?
Well, this is again a very good question. I'm not an expert on manipulation. Some of my friends who follow the gold market from a, say, insider point of view, much closer than I do, like Eric Sprott, they are convinced that there was manipulation of the gold price. To this, I answer, I don't know. But if there was, and I hope there was, then the gold price will sooner or later explode on the upside. And I'm saying explode because there must be lots of naked shorts. And as the gold price moves up, they will have to cover. So I actually hope that the so-called conspiracy theorists that say that there was manipulation, and it may very well have been, I just don't know. I cannot say something I'm not 100% sure about. But if there was manipulation, I think the gold price has a huge potential on the upside.
Let's go back to the U.S. markets. As the stock market reached a peak in 2007, New York Stock Exchange margin debt reached a peak of $381 billion. Now with new highs being taken out each month in the current context, we're at $451 billion, that's again margin debt, and we've seen five consecutive months of all-time highs in terms of borrowing to go invest in stocks. How should an investor view these borrowed funds in the marketplace?
Well, in my opinion, investors, when you talk to them, they all agree we should buy low and sell high. But when it comes to actually action, they all buy high and sell low. And in my view, and it's not only my opinion, for instance, GMO that runs money, their expected future return for the next 7 years of the U.S. stock market is negative. I'm not sure it will be negative because it depends how much money the Fed will print. But I think at some point in the U.S., there will be opposition to money printing. In other words, some dissenting voices and so on. But if they continue to print, the Dow Jones could go to 150,000, to 1,500, to 1,500,000, to 15 million. Depends how much money you print. But watch the currency. So my view is, I don't know. But I told you at the beginning, we are in the fifth year of a bull market. By historical standards, this will not be followed by only a correction of the 10-20%, but by a major bear market. Now, does the bear market start here or from a higher diving board? I don't know. But I think it's the wrong time to invest in U.S. stocks at the present time.
The current intentions are here in the United States for a reduction of our global military presence. That may be fiscally responsible, that may be fiscally helpful. I wonder what your view is when we look at the U.S. dollar. How critical is the U.S. military presence to perpetuating sort of a shadow, if you will, of power and control of importance in a post-Bretton Woods monetary system? The dollar's still dominant, but on what basis?
Well, I think the days of domination are gone. Maybe the U.S. can drop some bombs and send in some drones and so forth, but they'll never control the ground. It's too messy. And the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan is a complete disaster. But, and this, the American public should realize, military expenditure flow into the pockets of a few people and massively, I repeat here, massively enrich them. And so the military complex is very powerful, and it's a very corrupt system, but this is simply the fact. And that's why the military will continue to be very large, not just in the U.S., but also elsewhere. This is about power and money. Now, when it comes to military in the U.S. compared to other countries, as I said, the U.S. problem is that they have, I wrote about this recently, but I forgot, something like 200 military bases all over the world. Now, say there is a conflict close to Russia. How many troops can they allocate to that? If there is a problem close to China, how many troops can they allocate to that? The U.S. military, relative to the rest of the world, its importance has also gone down. Plunged. And the U.S. military actions around the world have created more enemies than friends.
Many people have suggested a historical analogy between the U.S. and Rome. Certainly what you just said reminds us of an empire that is spread thin. Maybe that's where the analogy ends. We want to look at commodities in general. Commodities did move as a pack 5 to 7 years ago. Today we have industrial commodities very much off their peak numbers, while precious metals are as well, as we discussed a moment ago. At least since the beginning of the year, precious metals have done well. As you mentioned, the miners have done exceptionally well, while the industrial complex has, the industrial metals has not done so well. How do you see this segmentation going forward?
Well, this is correct. But I think investors have to understand, it's like the stock market. Since the beginning of the year, most stocks are down, but a few stocks are up, and they're driving the index. And in the commodity complex, different commodities move at different times. The price of orange juice and coffee and cocoa has nothing to do with global economic growth. It has to do with supply. And talking about commodities, as an example, some industrial commodities are down, whereby I think they're bottoming out at the present time, whereas say coffee jumped by 70% in the last 4 months. And so each investor has to be very careful which commodity he chooses. Now, the individual investor is not well informed enough, as I am not well informed enough to choose all the time the commodities that will move the most. So I stick essentially to precious metals. I stick mostly to gold, whereby I have to say that there will be times when silver moves up more than gold, and other times when platinum moves up more than gold, other times when platinum moves up. But I personally, I own physical gold, and I continue to accumulate physical gold. And I think the central bankers we have today, like all academics, they will never admit that they made a mistake. What they will say is, we didn't do enough, so they'll print even more.
I'm very curious to see what the results are. In April, we have the second conference in a row. Last year was the first. I think this is the second year at the University of California, Berkeley, sponsored by the World Gold Council. And the discussion point, the executive meeting, is for central bankers to learn how to utilize gold as a reserve asset. Does this speak to a fundamental shift, either in the direction of gold or away from dollars, or just a recalibration completely of the world global monetary system?
Central bankers in general hate gold because the price of gold tells you some truth which they don't want to broadcast. I mean, no matter that the gold price has come down in the last 2 years from 1900 to at the low below 1200, the fact is simply that it is up from 250 in 1999. And has way outperformed even after the decline and after the colossal rise in U.S. stocks, it has outperformed stocks. And central bankers, that I guarantee you, unless the market forces discipline on them and completely discredits them, they will never accept the gold standard. Never. But the market one day will discredit them completely. Unfortunately, these completely uneducated people that just went to universities and have a university degree and have never worked a single day in their life in the private sector. These people after everything collapses, they will be hired by some stupid financial institution to give speeches for $260,000 a pop. I hope the financial institutions by then will also be bankrupt, so they won't be able to pay these useless central banks.
Well, to frame the issue of where you see the greatest risks and potential rewards, I have a thought experiment for you. Mark Fauber takes a hiatus from the financial markets, and you haven't really decided yet whether or not you're going to be gone for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, but you want to take a hands-off approach for those periods. How do you arrange your affairs financially before stepping away in light of your current anticipations?
Well, I think if I, say, didn't know where I'm going and for how long and so forth, I think I would invest most of my money in real estate and precious metals. And maybe I would own some quality companies where I would think that they will survive. They'll survive the worst hardship, but maybe their stock prices drop 50%. But never mind, at least you still have something. I would avoid cash and sovereign debt.
Avoiding cash and sovereign debt is intriguing because there is certainly an argument, whether it is the argument of demography driving deflation or mountains of debt driving us towards a deflationary collapse. It seems perhaps you're taking the other view that the central banks of the world will fight tooth and nail to avoid a deflationary downward spiral.
Well, I'm convinced eventually you do get the deflationary collapse, but I wouldn't bet that you get it tomorrow. You understand? Maybe, say, an index of prices of assets is today at 100. In theory, we can go up to 1,000, we can go up to 500, we can go up to 100,000 before the collapse happens. This is the challenge. When do you know when the collapse happens? For sure it will happen. I mean, for sure. That I guarantee. For that, I'm prepared to make a bet. I am prepared to make a bet from what level of Dow Jones and gold prices and the real estate prices. That I'm not prepared to, because I've seen in hyperinflation countries, prices go up 300-400 times, sometimes a million times before the collapse came. That's why I'm suggesting real estate is not such a bad option. It's not the best option, but it's one option to have some money in solid assets. Now, real estate also depends where it is and the location and the price you pay for and. But I'm suggesting cash and government bonds and bonds in general in this bubble environment may not be desirable. Having said that, I bought recently some 10-year treasuries at a yield of close to 3% because I want to have an exposure if the stock market has a big decline. So in other words, I'm buying a put on the stock market with treasuries, the put being relatively inexpensive.
So in a short-term view, that seems to be an attractive trade. And from a long-term view, sovereign debt and cash could be avoided.
Yes, completely unattractive.
You know, we have the issue also of how we account for our deficits in the United States, and last year was quite an improvement. From 2012, we went from $1,089 billion as the headline deficit, and it was reduced to $680 billion. Why is it, do you think, governments avoid using the same kind of accounting which corporations are required to use, the generally accepted accounting principles?
Well, if they use corporate accounting, GAAP accounting standards, with the unfunded liabilities, the deficit would be something like $6 trillion annually for the last few years. So they don't want to tell the truth. But the fact is simply, either in future, benefits will have to be cut significantly, or you have to print your money out of the problem. Both options are not very desirable. Moreover, no politician in the U.S. will ever go to the public and say, look, I'm very sorry, it's not my fault. For 30 or 40 years, we lived above our standard of living. We lived way beyond of what we earn. Now it's payback time. Now we need austerity for 3 or 4 years to bring back the financial position of the government in a proper proportion. That will never happen. because that kind of politician who goes to the Social Security recipient, the food stamp recipient, they will have to cut your benefits. He is not going to be elected, period. So you have to keep on promising the heaven on earth, which inevitably will not happen. It will get worse and worse.
Well, there's never a dull moment in the financial markets, and as we've discussed today, and as you often do in your newsletter, always well worth the read, there's opportunity juxtaposed with crisis. And we appreciate your insights. We appreciate the work that you do. I've been reading you for years and years and years, and would encourage our listeners to do the same.
Great, I love you.
And look forward to publishing of the next book, whatever that may be, whenever it may be. You have a way of teaching and bringing insights very unique with a historical and cyclical context in mind. So do take some time off so that you have the energy to put forth another effort. Look forward to your published works. Thanks for joining us again, Mark.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Mark Faber. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com. Also, you can get our latest video, What is Real Money, at McIlvaney.com, or go to YouTube and type in McIlvaney Financial.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.